Well, thanks for coming this afternoon. My name is Jan Drew Enright, and we're here to discuss The Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver. We'd just like to take a moment to pause and say a quick prayer for Lydia, our housemate, who twisted her ankle on the way up to our mile-high chalet. So let's just take a moment and think of Lydia. Amen. Okay, so we're here to talk about the Poisonwood Bible, but what I would like to do, could I get someone to be a recorder here at the whiteboard for me? Other Lydia?
I'll see if I can get over there.
Okay, that's right. If you twist your ankle, we're going to know there's some bad stuff going on. What I would like to know is your first name, and if you could give me the title of a book that you always recommend. One that, you know, like somebody says, oh, I need something to read. If there is a title that you want to recommend. So we're going to start here.
Don't start with here.
Susan?
I'm Susan, the book thief.
The book thief. Thank you. Paul?
I'm Paul, and I will say The Hammer of God by Bo Yeats.
Okay.
We're going to slow down. So.
Yeah. Our recorders.
Yeah.
Might need two recorders.
Hammer of God. I can record. Should I record so we go every other one?
Sure. That sounds great.
I'm Glenn, and The Year of Living Biblically by A.J. Jacobs.
Okay.
I'm Katie, and I guess... Actually, I would honestly, if I wasn't here, I would say the Poisonwood Bible.
Okay, that's all right.
Because
that's what I would say, too. Let's go back to Nancy.
Water for Elephants.
Oh, okay. Good.
Water for Elephants.
Pig.
Okay. I would say Seven Story Mountain.
Is that by
Thomas
Merton? Okay. S T O R E Y.
Name.
And that's Peg.
Peg?
Mm-hmm. What we're doing now is giving our first name and the name of a book that we always recommend. So I'll give you a minute to think. We'll go back to Greg.
I'm Greg. I'd say Ceremony by Leslie Mormon Silver.
Okay.
I'm Sharon. Christ the Lord out of Egypt.
Anne Rice.
Dan Rice.
What? Okay.
Christ
the Lord out of Egypt.
Yes.
Okay.
Miriam, Secret Daughter by Shelby Galvez Maya.
So the title is The Secret Daughter?
Secret Daughter.
Secret Daughter. Okay, good. We'll go to Cindy.
Miriam.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh. All right. Cindy.
Cindy.
Okay. Cindy Sabbath by, is it Mullen? M-U-L-L-E-N.
I don't know. Okay, good.
Lauren, and I like the red tent.
I need a diamond. Okay. Let's see, we'll stay back row.
And Molly, and just recently completed the trilogy beginning with The Englishman's Boy by Vanderhagen.
Englishman's Boy. Got that?
V-E-N-D-E-R-H-A-E-G-H-E. Okay. Dutch last name. I did the best I could there. The Englishman's Boy, and then there's two others after that.
Very good. Sarah, we'll go with you.
Well, two of them are already up there, so
that's
I
okay.
Say, I really enjoyed Anne Lamott's books.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you have one in particular?
Not off the top of my head.
No. Okay.
Gracie Mitchell.
We'll pick for you.
Plan B.
Bird by bird.
Norma and... somebody took my thunder with Red Tent, so I think I'll go along with Red Tent.
Okay, that's fine. Red Tent gets two votes.
I'm Karen, and Animal Dreams by Barbara
Kingsolver.
Oh, that's good.
Great.
I'm Anita, and Ethan Frome, but I can't remember the name of the author. She also wrote House of Mirth.
Edith Wharton.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Knitter.
Anne Lamott.
What's the knitter's
name? Grace Eventually.
Grace Eventually. And your name is?
Carol.
Carol. If your name was Anne Lamott, I was going to get really, really excited. I always pictured you with dreads.
Long hair. Long hair.
Beth, and I guess I'll say The Prodigal Son by Adrienne Allen.
Oh, okay.
I'm having a hard time, but
I recently listened to The Blessing, and I told someone else the audio was screwed.
The Blessing is that by
it's
Nicholas Sparks or somebody like that?
No, it's not Nicholas Sparks.
Okay. And your name?
Susan.
Susan. And who did we miss? Some latecomers.
It's not The Blessing, it's The Blessings.
The Blessings?
Yeah.
More than one?
Oh, Blessings.
Okay, good. You guys are doing great over here. Let's see. Name? Book you always recommend? Kathleen?
I'm blank right now.
Okay. Marilyn, do you have a book that you'd like to recommend to people?
You have time to think about that.
That's okay.
I just finished a Sarah's Quilt.
Okay, Sarah's Quilt.
I have The Great Emergence.
Oh, yeah. Phyllis Tickle.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Is this the one I'm missing?
Yeah.
Emergence.
Okay, is there anybody else that would like to share their name and the title of a book that you recommend often?
We haven't gotten Lydia's title.
Lydia's title.
Okay.
I'll write it down for you, Lydia.
Ken Wilson's Jesus Brand Spirituality.
Jesus
Brand Spirituality. It's one of my new favorites.
Okay. Good, good. Well, we're here to talk about a book that's a favorite of mine as well as for some others. There might be some of you that haven't read Poisonwood Bible, and that is A-okay with me. There might be some of you that hate the Poisonwood Bible, and that is also A-okay with me. We are not here to judge. We're just here to talk about books. I hope you like reading. If you don't like reading, I may have to ask you to leave. But other than that, you're A-okay with me. I just did a little review because I read this book when it first came out in about 98 or 99. And you know, the brain cells, they all go. But just as a little bit of a review so we can refer to the characters commonly, the Price family is the name of the people that we're going to be probably talking about most today. The Reverend Nathan, I'm sure none of you have ever forgotten, even in your sleep, and his wife Orleana, and they have four daughters. Their oldest daughter, Rachel, you may remember, is called the Termite because she is so blonde. She is blonde, 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 has no eyelashes, and she's very proud of her blonde hair. She's the oldest of their girls when they go to the Congo. She is 15 years old. Followed closely by the twins, Leah and Ada. Anybody remember what the situation is with Leah and Ada?
Well, Ada is the one who thinks in palindromes.
Ada thinks in palindromes. Did you hear that? She often has words go forwards and backwards, very concerned with balance. What's another striking thing about Ada? Does anybody remember?
Her limp.
Mm-hmm. She has some disorder that is explained to the children that as they were twins in the womb, basically she gave over her strength to her twin, Leah. So Leah is perfectly formed, very robust, very healthy. Ada is sort of shriveled on one side, limps greatly, doesn't only uses one hand. And what's one other interesting thing about Ada? Anybody remember?
Her own name is a palindrome.
Her own name is a palindrome. She does not speak. She does not speak until quite a bit later in the novel. She thinks very clearly. She's obviously extremely bright, but she chooses not to speak. Okay, so that's another thing. And then followed by the tag-along, Ruth May, who's only about 5 years old when they get there. So it's a family from Georgia, from Bethlehem, Georgia. The Reverend believes that he has been called by the Lord to go and evangelize in darkest Congo. And disaster ensues. Okay, so what I would like to start off with is another thing that you may or may not remember is that the story is told in several different voices. Nathan is never given a voice, and we're going to talk about that later. But each of the other female characters are given a part of the story. They're able to talk a little bit about how they see things from their point of view. And I've handed out readings to different people. So let's start out with Rachel, the oldest daughter. Who has Rachel's reading? Katie, if you would read that for us.
Okay. The way I see Africa, you don't have to like it, but you sure have to admit it's out there. You have your way of thinking, and it has its, and never the train we shall meet. You just don't let it influence your mind. If there's ugly things going on out there, well, you put your good stout lock on your door and check twice before you go to sleep. You focus on getting your own little place. place set up perfect as I have done, you'll see. Other people's worries don't necessarily have to drag you down. I amaze myself sometimes at what I have personally been through and then remain still in one piece. Sometimes I really think I owe the secret of my success to that little book I read long ago called How to Survive 101 Calamities.
Calamities.
Oh my gosh. You see it in print, you're like,
oh. Calamities.
Yeah. How to Survive 101 Calamities. Simple remedies for a dire situation, that's the lesson. In a falling elevator, try to climb up on the person nearby so their body will cushion your landing. Or in a crowded theater, when everyone's hightailing it for the fire exit, stick your elbow hard into the ribs of your neighbor to wedge yourself in, then pick up your feet so you won't get trampled. That is how people frequently lose their lives in a riot. Somebody steps on your heel and then walks right up till you're flat and they're standing on you. That's what you get for trying to stand on your own two feet. You end up getting crushed. So that's my advice. Let others do the pushing and shoving and just you just ride along. In the end, the neck you'll save will be your own. Perhaps I sound unchristian, but let's face it, when I step outside my own little world at night and listen to the sounds out there in the dark, what I feel down in my bones is that I am not a Christian kind of, this is not a Christian kind of place. This is darkest Africa where life roars This is darkest Africa where life roars by you like a flood and you grab whatever looks like it will hold you up. If you ask me, that's how it will be, it shall ever be. You stick out your own elbows just to hold yourself up.
Thank you. Is Rachel coming back into your mind now?
Mm-hmm.
What else do you remember about Rachel? It's been so long. I think it's very telling that she really does. She literally does put her elbows up and gets carried along that way when the ants are overtaking the village and everyone has to run down to the river. You know, I mean, they could have perished. And she suddenly remembers probably the one book she ever read in her life, which was How to Survive a Calamity. And she in a mob, she puts her elbows up, and that's what she ends up doing throughout the book. She's a survivor. She's not the smartest person in the world. She's not the nicest person in the world. She has a lot of malapropisms that are just hilarious, but she's a survivor. She's a survivor. Anything else that you remember about Rachel? Kind of in the pecking order of the daughters or anything about?
I don't remember her as being a very deep person. It's just pretty shallow. Mm-hmm. Surface.
She's the one who, her one possession that she brought from America was a mirror. Which tells you, and then one of their local people that helps them, the little boy Pascal, devises a little wicker basket so that the mirror can be mounted on the wall, which makes it sort of like a tourist attraction then, because everyone comes in and looks at the mirror. And when the ants are overrunning the city, what does she run back to get? Not her sisters, not, you know, her, but her mirror. So, you know, that I think that pretty much sums up Rachel for us. I think Leah and Ada are going to be an interesting part of our discussion today. What do you remember about them? We've talked about Ada a little bit, that she was the one that was physically handicapped, the one who chose not to speak. What about Leah?
It's been a while, but she always had that guilt a little bit from having to, that she got the one who has the strength between the two of them, so she feels a connection that she, I mean, obviously there's a twin connection, but mm-hmm. even more so that she kind of needs to make sure to help out her sister.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What else about Leah? What about her relationship with her parents? Anybody remember that? Her father in particular?
And she was the closest to him.
Mm-hmm. And how did she engender that closeness? Or how did she try to stay close to him? Do you remember any of the details of that or any of that feeling?
She kind of wanted to do what he wanted.
She was not rebellious, no. She was a brown noser, really. I mean, she was always, you know, trying to kind of quote scripture and stand up for her father in the early days, you know. But she admired him very much for very little recognition on his part. He was not very interested in her. Does anybody remember what happens a little bit later? I mean, the book is divided where it's kind of their early days in Congo, kind of then the disaster that happens in Congo. And then I was surprised to remember how much of the book happens after the family sort of falls apart. I mean, there's about a third of the book is really from about 1961 or 1962 on, and when they're fragmented. So we don't need to talk about that if you know, we haven't gotten to that. We can continue our discussion of the characters if you want, and then kind of go chronologically, if that would be more helpful. So Leah and Ada, the twins, let's talk a little bit more about the palindrome thing. What do you think is interesting about that, Paul? Why do you think that's important?
Well, I was just in awe of the writing. Yeah, Barbara Kingsolver writes whole sentences that are palindromes. Mm-hmm. But I think she just comes off as so brilliant and insightful. Mm-hmm. It's the part of the book I remember the best.
Who's got Ada's reading? Would you read that for us, please?
Now I have found a language even more cynical than my own. In Kalanga, the word Zolo is used in three different ways, at least. It means most dearly beloved. Or it is a thick yellow grub, highly prized for fish bait. Or it is a type of tiny potato that turns up in the market now and then, always sold in bunches that clump along the roots like knots on a string. And so we sing at the top of our lungs in church, Tata Nzolo, to whom are we calling? I think it must be the God of small potatoes, that other dearly beloved who resides in North Georgia does not seem to be paying much attention to the babies here in Kalanga. They are all dying from kaka-kaka, the disease that turns the body to a small black pitcher, pitches it over, and pours out all its liquid insides. The heavy rains brought the disease down the streams and rivers. Everyone in this village knows more about hygiene than we do, we have lately discovered. While we were washing and swimming in the stream any old place, there were rules, it turns out. Wash clothes downstream, where the Forest Creek runs into the Crocodile River. Bathe in the middle. Draw water for drinking up above the village. In Kalanga, these are matters of religious observance. They are baptism and communion. Even defecation is ruled by African gods, who command that we use only the bushes that Tatakuvudundu has sanctified for those purposes. And believe you me, he chooses bushes far away from the drinking water. Our latrine was probably neutral territory, but on the points of bathing and washing, we were unenlightened for the longest time. We have offended all the oldest divinities in every thinkable way. Tata Nzolo, we sing, and I wonder what new disgusting sins we commit each day, holding our heads high in sacred ignorance while our neighbors gasp hand to mouth.
Don't you just want to applaud when you hear writing like that? So Ada's kind of got a bead on the situation pretty early, don't you think? The one who doesn't speak. So what does she see? She sees they're offending the local people. They're offending the local gods. They're offending hygiene rules. You know, it'd be like somebody, you know, peeing in the street of Holden Village. I mean, we would be offended by that. That'd be very offensive. So there's lots of things that they have they're ignorant, but they're still offensive. They're still offending a lot of people. And the language is quite complicated for a Westerner. So one word can mean, what was the first word?
Dearly beloved.
Dearly beloved, or it can mean a grub, or it can mean those little small potatoes. So she calls it the God of small potatoes, which is another great turn of phrase. You may remember, too, that later in the book, after they leave Africa, Ada becomes a physician. She becomes very interested in infectious diseases, and she's, you know, takes her experiences in Africa and sort of brings those all to light, brings a very informed sense of all the things that can go wrong when you're living in a climate like that. Who's got Leah's reading?
I do.
Okay, will you please?
In exchange for his first taste of powdered milk, Pascal showed me a tree we could climb to find a bird's nest. After we handled and examined the pink-skinned baby birds, he popped one of them in his mouth like a jujube. Seemed to please him a lot. He offered a baby bird to me, pantomiming that I should eat it. I understood perfectly well what he meant, but I refused.
He did not seem disappointed to have to eat the whole brood himself. On another afternoon, Pascal showed me how to build a 6-inch tall house. Crouched in the shade of our guava, he planted upright twigs in the dirt. Then he built the twigs into walls with a sturdy basket weave of shredded bark all the way around. He spat in the dirt to make red mud, then patted this onto the walls until they were covered. Finally, he used his teeth to square off the ends of palm fronds in a businesslike manner for the roof. Finally, he squatted back on his heels and looked over his work with an earnest, furrowed forehead. The small house of Pascal's, I realized, was identical in material and design to the house in which he lived. It only differed in size. It struck me what a wide world of difference there was between our sort of games. Mother May I, hide and seek, and his, find food, recognize poison wood, build a house. And here he was, a boy no older than 8 or 9. He had a younger sister who carried the family's baby everywhere she went and hacked weeds with her mother in the manioc field. I could see that the whole idea and business of childhood was nothing guaranteed. It seemed to me, in fact, like something more or less invented by white people and stuck onto the front end of grown-up life like a frill on a dress. For the first time ever, I felt a stirring of anger against my father for making me a white preacher's child from Georgia. This wasn't my fault. I bit my lip and labored on my own small house under the guava tree. But beside the perfect talents of Pascal, my own hands lumbered like pale flippers on a walrus out of its element. My embarrassment ran scarlet and deep, hidden under my clothes.
Which daughter was that?
Leah, one of the twins. Physically most resourceful one. She's the one that kind of figures out about food, and she learns how to hunt, and she's not afraid to kind of go out. She's in some ways most like her father in her boldness. She's very bold and will go out and try things, and in a lot of ways keeps them alive when things get a little sketchy.
Can I interrupt and ask about the poison wood?
Sure. Anybody remember why it's called the Poisonwood Bible, or what the confusion is about the poisonwood? It's another example, like you read about a word that could be pronounced two different ways, from what I recall. And if you pronounce it one way, it's like holy or Jesus or, you know, something religious. But if you pronounce it slightly different, it's pronounced poisonwood, which in that area was a weed that would just make you break out and scratchy, and it was just horrible, kind of like poison ivy, I imagine. And so the father was always railing and using these phrases that he didn't really understand. And he was saying, you know, Jesus is the Jesus of the Poisonwood Bible. And all the local people are like, well, why would we want to worship a God like that? I mean, the poisonwood is going to make you crazy, you know. And it was kind of a really obvious indication of his misunderstanding of so much. Which leads us to Nathan, who is way too easy to hate, right? Let's name the reasons why we hate Nathan.
He's arrogant.
What else?
Ignorant. Just doesn't get it.
Does not get it.
Blind.
He won't rude. Ask questions.
Won't ask questions?
Rude.
Very rude. Why is Nathan in Africa? And what was he supposed to do in Africa?
Preach, turn the natives into Christians.
Mm-hmm. And you want to build a church.
Build a church. Mm-hmm. Baptize. Mm-hmm. He's very obsessed, very focused on baptism. Anybody remember what the issue is with baptism when they first get there and he proposes having a big baptism?
It's in the river or something.
And what else is in the river? Crocodiles, you know. And you would be nuts to ever go to the river, let alone let your children go to the river. But again, because of his arrogance, because he doesn't ask questions, he fixates on things. He's fixated on getting them down to the river, you know, because sprinkling, of course, wouldn't be good enough because he's going to have to get them immersed in the river. And so he is so easy to hate. I mean, he's just, he's beyond redemption. So why does she, go ahead.
The other example I remember is the garden.
That's yeah. what I was thinking.
And remember? He just scoffed at the way they planted things, and then their seed just washed out in a matter mm-hmm. of days.
Yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. He's very black and white.
Yeah. And they have a maid, a mama who lives with them, who tries to tell them how to plant the garden. No, you need to do it in mounds. And he just, well, he had a fabulous garden in Georgia, so why would she think as a woman that she knew anything? And so he plants it the Georgia way, and yeah, it gets washed away, and the seeds are wasted, and all of that. So why does King Solver, I mean, you got to have a villain, right? But is he too easy of a villain? I mean, is he too, can anyone speak to the defense of Nathan Price?
I always just, it's been so long since I read it, but I just felt so bad for him because he was so ignorant. I just kept thinking, oh my gosh, this poor guy, just everything he does, and I kept thinking, what is he thinking on the inside that as he's so sure that this is what God sent him to do, and then everything he does, just, by the end, I didn't like him, but I really felt sorry for him too. I felt like he's so blind that he doesn't even see. Mm-hmm. And everything he did just turned out so poorly. Mm-hmm. Although he was convinced it was God's will that mm-hmm. he be there.
He would not change course.
No.
He would not change course. And, you know, I always think, well, you know, he's a product of his upbringing. Or, you know, he had this terrible experience in World War II where he escaped the Bataan Death March. And all of the people in his company went on the death march, so he was basically the only one to survive. So he came home from the war, his wife said, a different man. He never laughed again. He never had joy in his life. I mean, he was black and white. He was fixated. He was. And another little detail I'd forgotten is that basically the Baptist mission board said, don't go there. We don't want you to go there. You are not prepared. And they went anyway. They kind of, he sort of, you know, harangued his home church into raising the money, which they were probably glad to do to get him out. And then he moved the family over there. When everyone knew that politics were really heating up, that the government was probably going to change, Belgian rule was, you know, going to be on its way out. But he had, you know, his idea that this was his mission, that's what he was going to do, and there was no stopping him. Is there anything else that you remember about Nathan that's at all enlightening, helps you get any insight to him or any explanation? Do you think he's a realistic character?
Unfortunately, I think he's very realistic. I mean, honestly, if you've spent any time overseas, you do a lot of those things, whether you want to admit it or not. You know, we show up in new cultures with ignorance and clumsiness, and you know, he lacks any shred of awareness, which makes him kind of unique. But the clumsiness and the gaffes are not unique at all to being in a different culture.
I like to think most of us, I mean, even coming to Holden, you know, the first day you're just like, this is a new culture, I don't understand this culture. But what you hope to do is kind of watch what other people do and figure it out, or learn from your mistakes. Oh, I don't put my glasses here. You know, you hope that you're aware enough that you can learn from those things. But he really had no interest, I don't think.
He didn't have anybody to ask, did he?
Well, he was surrounded by people that would have told him.
Oh, but I mean, of his own culture.
Well,
you know, if he had a partner that he was going along, he was too proud to ask.
Remember, Orleana butchered the chickens and fried them up and had a picnic one of their first Sundays. When he was first trying to baptize people, and they were, you know, shaking their head, his wife butchered some very valuable chickens, fried them, and passed it around the village. So what does that mean?
She knows how to reach out to people.
She knew how to give.
How to begin building relationships. Mm-hmm.
She knew how to accept help, which if she hadn't, they would have starved long before.
Yeah.
they did almost starve to death. So she had a very kind of primary sort of insight to human nature. She would say, on market day, I can talk to any woman in the world on market day. We all understand what it is to have to get some food to take back home. You know, that's universal. So she put herself in of at least understanding others as being similar to her, having similar worries as her. We're going to talk about Orleana last. So let's go to the Ruth May reading. Remember Ruth May? She's just sort of the little blonde running around, and she's the first one to kind of make friends with the other kids because she picks up the language a lot faster and very headstrong, energetic, sort of the spoiled youngest. Go ahead, Lydia.
Father is trying to teach everybody to love Jesus, but what with one thing and another around here, they don't. Some of them are scared of Jesus, and some aren't, but I don't think they love him. Even the ones that go to church, they still worship the false dolls and get married to each other time and again. Father gets right put out about it. I'm scared of Jesus, too. When she came back from the woods, we hooped and hollered and ran to the porch and just jumped up and down and pulled her inside by her shirt tails. But uh-oh. There was Father in his dark bedroom doorway looking out. All you could see was his eyes. We didn't want to get the same medicine, so we just looked at Leah real hard with I'm sorry for you eyes and tried to get a nice message across. After we went to bed, I reached over through the mosquito net and held her hand. Mama didn't sleep in her room. Mama says birds are going to be her death. I'd sooner say it was snakes, but I guess if a bird is going to eat up the dead children's souls, that is a worry. There is one more sound to listen for at night, one more thing you can't say out loud after dark.
So that's from the five-year-old who's heard about Jesus and who's heard about false idols, which is what her father is always warning the local people about. Do not worship those false idols. And what about little Ruth May? What do you remember about her?
I remember the Black Mamba.
You know, I've read this book. I know what happens, but I was rereading the section and weeping today. How can it be? How can it be? And the bird that they're talking about there is, you may remember, they had an owl that Leah was going to kind of domesticate, and that was very, very bad luck in that culture. And so she had to get rid of the owl, take it back out to the woods. But it was considered, it was like the ancestors would see you, and then, you know, you would have death in your home. And then the other bird was Methuselah, the parrot, that the father got angry at and kicked out because he used bad language, which turns out to have been something that his wife uttered when she couldn't get the stove to work. So Methuselah got the boot, and then the owl. So birds were about the death of her. But, you know, we get a little preview to what's going to happen with the mamba snake and Ruth May. So is this going to be a spoiler? Ruth May is the one who's killed by the snake. You know, they're getting to more and more tension. Terrible things are starting to happen. The people are starting to really turn against the missionary family. Like, they're the ones that are causing all the trouble. And the people that have been kind to them are not being as kind to them anymore. And so the local witch doctor, which is what the father calls him, starts to, you know, leave things around, chicken bones and things like that, that of course, the father doesn't pick up on any of this. And then eventually plants the mamba snake in the chicken house, which is where their orphan boy that they have live with them and let them help. His name is Nelson, usually sleeps. But Nelson knows not to go in there. And when they go in the next day to investigate, the snake is there, has killed all of the chickens. And then when it slithers out, then it gets Ruth May, who is 6 years old at the time. So that's when, of course, the great decline happens. And that's when Orleana finally says enough and just walks right wraps the baby up in a shroud, brings a table out and puts the child on it, brings everything they own from the house out and just to give away, and then just starts walking down the road. And that's the end of the, that's the end of that chapter for her. She walks down the road with her children, three of her children behind her, but no husband, because he stays behind. Heartbreak. Let's take a look at Orleana now. And that's kind of a long reading. Norma, are you okay with that, or do you want to split it up?
Well, it's basically just, if you go by your markings, it's here and just down here.
Yep, yep.
Okay, that's fine.
That would be great if you would go for it. This is sort of Orleana's take on what happened in the Congo while they were there.
The sting of a fly, the Congolese say, can launch the end of the world. How simply things begin. Maybe it was just a chance meeting, a Belgian and an American, let's say, two old friends with a hunger in common, a hand in the diamond business. A fly buzzes and lights. They swatted away and stepped into the Belgian's meticulously polished office in Elizabethville. They're careful to ask after each other's families and profits, and to speak of how they are living in a time of great change, great opportunity. A map of the Congo lies on the mahogany table between them. While they talk of labor and foreign currency, their hunger moves apart from their gentlemanly conversation with a will of its own, licking at the edges of the map on the Bible, dividing it between them. They take turns leading forward to point out their moves with shrewd conjugality, playing it like a chess match, the kind of game that allows civilized men to play at make-believe murder. Between moves, they tip their heads back, swirl blood-colored brandy in glass globes, and watch it crawl down the curved glass in liquid veins. Languidly, they bring their map to order. Who will be the kings, the rooks, the bishops rising up to strike at a distance? Which sacrificial pawns will be swept aside? African names will roll apart like the heads of dead flowers crushed idly between thumb and forefinger. Igoma, Mukuji, Mukwela, Kasabulu, Lumumba, they crumble to dust on the carpet. Behind the gentlemen's barbered heads, dark mahogany planks stand at attention. The paneling of the office once breathed the humid air of a Congolese forest, give shelter to life, felt the scales of snake belly on its branches. Now the planks hold their breath with their backs to the wall. So do the mounted heads of rhinoceros and cheetah, evidence of the Belgian skill as a sport hunter. Cut down, they are now mute spies in the house built by foreigners. Outside the window, palm fronds rattle in a rising wind. An automobile creeps past, leaves of unraveling newspaper blow into the ragged water that runs in an open ditch. The newspaper wheels along the street, scattering its sheets onto the water, where they float as translucent squares of lace. No one can say whether it's good news or bad. A woman strides alongside the ditch under her basket of roasted corn. When the Belgian rises to close the windows, the scent of all of this reaches him. The storm, the ditch, the woman with the corn. He shuts the window and returns to the world of his own making. The curtains are damask. The carpet is Turkish. The clock on the table, German, old but still accurate. The heads on the wall observe with eyes of imported glass. The perfect timepiece ticks, and in that small space between seconds, the fancy has turned to fact. Given time, legions of men are drawn into the game, both above, both ebony and ivory, the Congo's CIA station chief, the National Security Council, even the President of the United States. And a young Congolese man named Joseph Mobutu, who walked barefoot into a newspaper office to complain about the food he was getting in the army. A Belgian newspaper manager recognized wit and raw avarice, a useful combination in any game. He took the young Mobutu under his wing and taught him to navigate the airy heights where foreigners dwell, a rook who would be king, and the peace that will fall. Patrice Lumumbu, a postal worker elected to head his nation. The Belgians and Americans agree Lumumba is difficult, altogether too exciting to the Congolese, and disinclined to let white control the board, preferring the council and company of black. The players move swiftly and in secret. Each broad turn sweeps across rivers, forests, continents, and oceans, witnessed only by foreign glass eyes and once mighty native trees cut away from their roots.
So that's how she imagines it. A Belgian and a Congolese, or Belgian and an American, getting together and plotting the overthrow of a government, change of the guard, all of that. Contrast that with earlier in the book when Orleana was concerned about if they had enough cake mixes so each girl could have a birthday cake, a Betty Crocker birthday cake mix, while they were in Africa for 1 year, not realizing, of course, that the cake mix would turn to a brick and that they didn't really have an oven in order to bake a cake. So contrast that woman with a woman who later leaves her husband, you know, gets out of the country with only one of her children, and is able to formulate kind of a political framework such as that. What happened? What all happened to Orleana?
Incredible struggle providing for her family in Africa to put food on the table and to care for them. Mm-hmm. Really intense hardship.
Mm-hmm. The change of cultures is not easy either. Whether even if everything had been level, mm-hmm. initiated in the language. Mm-hmm.
For anyone. She makes an explanation at the end as to why she didn't leave him sooner. She says, you know, many people would have told me years earlier that I needed to leave him, but she wasn't able to, for whatever reason. Lots of reasons, that many of which were enough, I'm sure, to stay with him. But she's the one, to me, that really changes the most and really shows the most, exhibits the most strength, I think, ultimately. She kind of comes through it and does the best that she can in a really awful situation, and does things that she probably didn't ever think that she would have to do. Which brings us back to the question I posed in my introduction on the board. Can Christianity be exported? Should those people have been going to Congo? Or should people, maybe not as deeply flawed as Nathan, but others, good-hearted Christian people, should they be sent? Is that our calling? Is that our mission?
I remember, it's been years since I read it, but I remember thinking, my gosh, what did we do to our own native people? Under the guise of making them Christians. It's just sad how we totally ignore the culture, and ours is best.
I think of two really outstanding films that play in the fields of the Lord, mm-hmm. and The Mission, which I think mm-hmm. is the main focus
yeah.
for opening that to the old world and the new world. Mm-hmm. And I found both very powerful. Mm-hmm. And painful.
Yeah.
And then Prune and I have done a number of immersion experiences in New Mexico at some of the pueblos, and firsthand talking, they carry with them that history of pain and devaluation, disregard, no appreciation of the people and who they are and what they believe, and murderous events for hundreds of years.
Slavery.
Slavery, yeah. The danger, I think, of a book like this sometimes is that you just are so disheartened by the whole thing mm-hmm. that you think, well, you know, forget it. But I think all of us can think of stories where missionaries have done wonderful things, helped with medical care, helped with schools, helped build bridges between different cultures. You know, there's... Go ahead.
I was just saying, I mean, I think part of the extremeness of Nathan's characters, it's so obvious for us to see how we could choose to do it differently. I mean, he makes so many obvious mistakes, and it's so easy for us to see that if he were to have just done it this way instead, mm-hmm. how it would be so dramatically different.
Mm-hmm. They find out after they're there and they're visited by the former missionary and his wife, who is African, the people from the mission board come to visit him and say, you know, you came here without permission. You didn't go through training. You didn't have language training. You didn't have your inoculations. I mean, they were completely unprepared. They just had a completely unrealistic idea of what it would be like. And so even in the late 1950s, my hope would be that people would come at least with some cultural understanding, some language ability. I mean, this was very extreme, as you said. Very extreme.
1 year, you said something about Orleana bringing in a cake for her birthday for 1 year. She really thought she was only going to be in this for 1 year.
That was their term. They had a 1 year term as missionaries.
And do you, from the storyline, how long were they there?
17 months. But the husband never left.
Right. Well, and the two older daughters.
And the two older daughters. Rachel ended up getting out with the pilot and living in sin with him in South Africa and really took to apartheid. You know, that was great for her. And then she ended up with a French diplomat, and then she ended up with someone else, an older man who left her a hotel. So then she ended up never going back. She stayed in Africa the remainder of her life.
South Africa.
No, she moved back up to Congo then, eventually.
Oh.
And then Leah married Anatoly and had a family.
My church supported a missionary in the Congo just recently, still supporting them. And he's a Congolese person. He's a physician. Mm-hmm. And he's busy repairing the damage done by the Belgians, who built canals which were let go and became breeding grounds for malaria, for mm-hmm. mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. So now they're teaching the villagers how to fill them in and repair the environment. So we're supporting, you know, we're... Work is still being done in those places to repair damage done by culture and by mm-hmm. former missionaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Belgium does not come off looking great in this book at all.
One of the worst of the worst, I thought.
Yeah, with the diamond mines, the rubber plantations, you know, cutting the workers' hands off if they didn't work fast enough. And I mean, just pretty bad stuff. Pretty bad stuff.
Sometimes I wondered if it was... a contrast to the story of Jonah. Jonah, as you remember, gave about the most judgmental hellfire and brimstone mess when he finally did go to the Ninevites. And then they all, you know, repented, including the animals. And I'm thinking, this guy's given like the worst possible message of Christianity that I could almost come up with. And yet, so did Jonah. So did Jonah. I mean, it's like, you know, so there's this little mustard seed side of me that thinks, okay, God can take the worst doggone message of Christianity, or God, you know, as we understand God, and still make something good come out of it. certainly did it with Jonah. Yet I'm not quite sure the good.
Did he do it in this case?
Did God
did
do
anything,
that?
Did
in
anything
this
good
case?
Come out of this?
Well, what about the daughter that became the epidemiologist or whatever she is? Mm-hmm. 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 The physician died.
Yeah. Ada did that. Mm-hmm. Leah remained in Africa, married an African, had four boys, taught, helped with farming and, helped with the country that was always shifting, always changing, governments, kind of going in and out. And her husband was jailed for a while because of his political beliefs.
And I think it's a gift for anyone to go into another country and to be able to be so accepting and open to the information given, not only by the country geographically, by the people themselves. And is it the Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Root? Wonderful book, story of representing the Dutch East India Company into Japan.
Mm.
Back in the 1700s.
Okay.
Not religiously background. He was there to make money for his company.
Yeah.
But I think it's a wonderful read on how at least one person could go to that other country
mm-hmm.
and be so open
mm-hmm.
to all that that was offered, including the sharing of language.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, Mother Teresa is an excellent example of
what,
a gift to India. That continues beyond her. I mean, we and personally, many of us probably know examples of that. So, I think it's pretty easy. It's like in our discussion yesterday with Gilead. It's pretty easy to paint a really broad brush. And if you weren't a person of faith, I think that this would just be another reason why Christianity has it wrong. What do you think? Is there anything about this novel that makes you think maybe Christianity has something right, something that we do want to take a field? Is that demonstrated?
Well, from the ashes of their life, Ada really blooms.
Mm-hmm.
She becomes a very different person.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Steve.
I'm just curious, I read the book a long time ago. Is there any presence in the novel? Is there any indication that there's Christianity in the Congo other than their mission effort? I mean, do they talk about Catholicism and Kimbangu Church? And
there's the point at which, kind of after everything falls apart, Leah goes and lives with the French nuns, or the Belgian nuns.
Mm-hmm.
And she works at a hospital, and she's a disaster as a nun. She, of course, is just trying to boss everybody around and wants to go hunting and things like that. But they hide her. She needs to be hidden at this point. She's in danger. And so that's about the only thing that I remember. There, there's a discussion in the Leopoldville. There's the kind of the mission board that oversees all the different denominations, Episcopalians and things, but not very much detail on that.
This is the question I would modify it and say, is there anything positive that comes out of Christianity? To say, is there anything positive that comes out of, Nathan's Christianity as opposed to Congolese Christianity or indigenous Christianity? But to assume that he was somehow the primary agent of spreading Christianity,
Which was his assumption,
right?
And he wasn't even he wouldn't even sit down with a Roman Catholic because, they're just papists and, they have it all wrong. And so, that's an excellent point. And what you were saying yesterday in your session about, the Christianity that was already there. I mean, we have this sort of, idea that, it's us and we're white. And so then we're going to take it other places rather than realizing Africa's, kind of next door to a lot of things that happened. And it's not such a stretch.
Have you ever heard, watch television occasionally on book talks and stuff in which Barbara Kingsolver has been there, but she's talked about her more nonfiction work and her short stories. That's where I first became familiar with her.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard her say why she wrote the book, and that's one thing that as I was going through, it's depressing. And it's almost as if she's saying, this is what this is what missionaries do.
Mm-hmm. Her parents were agricultural missionaries.
Yeah.
And so she did spend many years as a child or a teenager in Africa. I'm not sure if it was in the Congo. But there was another section that I did want to read to you. Another thing that's unusual about King Solver is that she is actually a biologist. And so this is what she said in an interview before she had published the Poisonwood Bible. Not only do we separate politics from art, but we also separate science from art. And King Solver says, that's for sure. And the interviewer says, and you certainly don't. And King Solver says, well, I can't. The natural world provides me with my philosophy and religion. My training is in evolutionary biology, and that's ultimately how I understand the workings of the world. My interest and passion in life science comes from having grown up among farmers, and also from parents who were deeply interested in natural history. They always told me the names of wildflowers and birds. I grew up in the milieu of creating education, entertainment, and pets out of snakes and turtles and every kind of thing we could find. Sometimes I think I have the slight advantage over many other writers because my background is so different from the average writers. While they were reading Shakespeare, I was dissecting planaria or learning plant taxonomy or unraveling plant-insect co-evolution, all these wonderful mysteries. I have at my disposal all these images that might seem stunning and fresh, like something new in literature, but actually they're just the everyday mysteries of life on Earth. I bring that world into my writing because that's who I am. So that's one insight to her that I think tells a little bit about it. She really does look at everything through the eyes of the natural world, I think, of some of the things that Ron was talking about this morning. So why do you think people have such strong opinions about the Poisonwood Bible? I've talked to more people in 2 days about it, and people have very, very strong opinions. Why do you think that is?
Well, it doesn't present missionary life in a very nice light.
Mm-hmm.
Or I think it doesn't show a good example of missionary.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's why people feel strongly about it?
Well, it could be that not just giving Christianity another bad name.
Right. I mean, it's not one of those books that's forgettable, I guess I would say. It's even though I've forgotten a whole bunch about it, but I remembered my reactions to it. And and most people said, I mean, 98% of the people I talked to said, I love that book. So why? Why do you think so many of us say it's in your top 10? Cindy?
I read it so long ago, but what I liked about it was the development of the characters. That I felt like sometimes you read books and you think, I couldn't tell you anything about them because they're just telling you what happened, but there isn't that development of the characters. But as you start talking about it, I'm like, oh, I remember that it was like when you got done that you really thought this family existed and that they were real people, and you got a good insight. I think that's why I liked it. I liked the development, and I also liked growing up with biologists around. I liked her descriptions of the natural world and how that all fit into all of it.
I think it was because she really made you care about the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Like when by the end of the book, I really wanted to know what happened to them.
Yeah.
And I still like to know what happened.
Yeah, I know. Because, in my life, those people just go on living. And, if I could visit them, then I could find out what's going on. So, but that's another session.
Our middle daughter was in an AP English class, and this was the summer reading assignment. So when they got to AP English in the fall of, I suppose, her senior year, they had to start the year by writing an essay on this book. And the first thing the teacher asked them to offer was just a general reaction, what they had thought or felt.
Mm-hmm.
And our Anna wrote, when I finished reading this book, I just thought, I have to go to Africa. And the teacher wrote beside it, take me with you. But it had that kind of compelling draw. It pulled you into these people's lives and into the lives of Africa and the Congo.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess for me, it wasn't just I was going to say this on the Nathan Price column. It's hard to tell sometimes if it's a comment about Christianity or about Americans or
yeah.
about man.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't necessarily want most of you in this room to answer that. But, you know, it's really complex that way. And certainly it's also a comment about how the Belgians and Europeans and we have been in the world at the expense of other peoples.
Well, because one of the themes that really runs throughout all of King Salter's books, and I have to say this is among my least favorite of her books, but I do like it because she is, I would say she's my favorite author, but it's that sense of everything is so interconnected and nothing that I do is just for myself, that there are ramifications that affect in all sorts of ways, and it's that wonderful, intricate interconnectedness of life in all of its forms.
Yeah.
That's a theme that is in all of her books.
Yeah.
Well, and like yesterday, the writing is just brilliant. Mm-hmm. Those voices are so distinctive. Mm-hmm. You didn't even need the names on the chapters, and you knew who was speaking.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're so different from one another. For one pen.
Yeah, or all of those.
To produce. And I think it worked on so many levels. It's a family story. It's an international story.
It's kind of a rollicking good tale. You know, there's a lot that happens, you know, and I think that's part of it too. Greg, what were you saying the other day or earlier today about the eyes? There was about that.
That's one of my favorite things. It's like how the African notion of we're just these little souls peeping through these little eye holes of our bodies, and that whole idea of permanence, of our bodies not being permanent, that, you know, so ever since I read that book, sometimes I feel like that I'm these little, you know, souls looking through eye holes into the world, but it's a really interesting concept of the impermanence of our bodies, you know.
And they were very peaceful about that. I mean, they mourned greatly when someone died, but they also knew that soul was still with them and, you know, continuing to kind of influence events and things like that. Any final thoughts?
Just the fact that in Uganda now, gays and lesbians can face execution because of two Christian missionaries.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, what a happy thought.
Did you say it? I didn't catch all that.
In Uganda, gays and lesbians can be executed, and that's because of the work of two Christian missionaries that are they American?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think they were.
That's
more work to be done. Tomorrow, we are going to be discussing Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese. If you haven't read it, if you're interested in kind of another kind of international one, this is a book that is set in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, in the 1950s and 60s, kind of the same era. And it starts out with a nun who is in labor with conjoined twins. So if that doesn't pique your interest, I don't know what is. So that's tomorrow, and I think there are copies of that in the bookstore and maybe in the library. Thursday we're talking about The Sparrow, which is another kind of missionary story, but in this case the mission field is outer space. It's Jesuits in outer space is my short handle synopsis for that. And it's the best discussion my book group ever had was after The Sparrow. And then on Friday we're talking about a book that's a little less known by John Hassler called Simon's Night, and it's about aging and faith and all that good stuff. So that's a quick read, too, and if you haven't read them and you'd like to talk, please comment.